In many backyards, along with the garden, you'll find members of the poultry family. Usually you see chickens, but there could also be ducks and geese. If you're trying to decide whether or not to have poultry in your backyard, listen to Access Utah today. Britt Merrill and Celia Bell are instructors with Wasatch Community Gardens. We'll explore the space needed, the breeds to look at, the food you'll need, as well as the care you'll need to give throughout the year. Those eggs don't come without a little work, but the rewards can be well worth the effort. And in the latest edition of Wild About Utah, learn about night jars. Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello, welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line from Salt Lake City is... I have two guests. We have first Britt Merrill. She's a community gardener and volunteer manager with Wasatch Community Gardens. Britt has been raising backyard chickens for 4+ years and was instrumental in helping Salt Lake City craft its updated chicken keeping ordinance. Also with Britt is Celia Bell. She's an urban farmer. Celia has a large plot of land where she's able to raise chickens and bees and grows the majority of the food that she eats. She has been raising chickens for 8+ years in Salt Lake City, as well as a couple of years in a more rural area. Celia teaches urban chicken keeping classes for the U of U's Lifelong Learning Program and for Wasatch Community Gardens. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, now, I have to reveal that I have chickens, and I've had them for about 13, 14 years, mainly because when we moved into the house, there was one chicken the previous owners couldn't catch, so we ended up having that chicken, and it just kind of branched out from there, so I kind of learned as I was going along, but they are well worth the effort to have. So I'm going to talk to you first, Celia. How did you first get into chickens, and what interested you?
I've been gardening for 14+ years, and I thought that they were the perfect complement for gardening. So their manure, their bug patrol, and yesterday I was doing a lot of weeding, and I just throw those weeds over into their chicken run, and they eat those, and just kind of completes the cycle in my yard.
You know, it is a great thing. We take all of our scraps from the house, and the chickens see that white bucket coming, and they all come running over because they know what they're going to get.
You've got them trained well.
And Britt, how about you?
I live in downtown Salt Lake City, and I have a neighbor across the street who keeps chickens right next to Charlie Square. And I found myself just going over there, you know, every day when I would come home from work just to hang out with his chickens. And to me, they're so calming, just they're pecking, and, you know, they come up to you when you go to visit them. They know you're going to bring them treats. And finally, my neighbor said, you know, I have a lot of chickens. He had close to 25. He said, I can give you a couple if you want to build a coop. And so that weekend, my husband and I, you know, found just like scrap material and built our coop. And sort of the next day, we went over towards while it was getting dark and grabbed a couple chickens and took them to their new home. So I've been keeping chickens ever since.
Yeah, you mentioned how they can sometimes come right up to you. Depending on the breed, I have a couple that will, when they see me, and if I'm hunting for eggs near the coop, they will. They're just used to me. They come right up to me. They wait to get scratched on the head, and then they're off on their own. So you can get attached.
I think chickens have amazing personalities. That's one of the things that surprised me the most when I started learning about and getting introduced to chickens is just the unique personalities. And a lot of that has to do with breed. There's definitely more sort of social breeds that are curious about people and like attention. And then there's definitely certain breeds that like to be very independent. They're much better at foraging and kind of don't really care if you're there or not.
I was going to say, my golden campine does not like to be around me at all, and she's very much her own personality, whereas I have a couple of the names just went out of my head. Anyway, there's a couple of other breeds that they always come right up to me, and they're really gentle, except when they're mothers, then they're not so gentle. But we'll get into that. So let's talk about how to first get started. Now, for me, it was a catalog. Other than the one that was left, it was a catalog order, and I'm not so sure I would go that route again, just because when I can get them locally, I have more control over what I'm getting. Because I first started out wanting to do it to just take him to the fair and see what would happen.
Nice. And did you have to order 25?
Yep, I had to order 25. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there were three of us that were splitting the order, so I didn't have to have 25 to begin with.
Right. Yeah, I've definitely ordered that way as well. The first time I ordered chickens was from Murray McMurray.
That was me too.
Yeah, and you have to order 25, and it's so fun to look at that catalog and decide what breeds you're going to get, and all just the variation in chicken size and color and combs and foot feathers and caps.
And they do come in the mail. And they do come in the mail.
And they come in the mail, and the post office calls you up, and whenever they call you, you have to rush over there because the chicks are less than a day old, and they need to get to your house and to a safe place where they have access to water and food. But I agree. I don't know that I would order again by mail, especially because there's so many good alternative options, like our local IFA stores carries a great selection. And they're also local breeders who specialize in a couple of different varieties, and you can get them from them.
Well, one of the things I hadn't really considered was if I wanted to have chickens large enough to take to the fair, I had to order them early enough in the year so that they had reached the proper size. So we're talking February when I had to order. So it's not exactly warm, and chicks need to have temperatures in the 90s when they're first starting out. So I had to arrange a place to have them.
Yeah, and actually, I know, Celia, you ordered. Most people tend to get chickens in the spring. You kind of think Easter chicks. But I know Celia does the opposite. She orders them in the fall. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Celia.
Last year was actually the first year I did that, and I was Julie Clifford, who sells eggs at the downtown farmers market. She's the one that suggested that to me, and I am hooked. I want to do that, but that also makes me more reliant on having to mail order them, which it is so fun now. IFA has so many different breeds to select from, so being able to go in there and peruse the chicks is a lot of fun. So I've done both, but it's really nice to be raising baby chicks in August because, like you said, you need to have them at 95 degrees, 90 degrees, and that's about what the temperature is right then. So took less energy to raise them because I just had my heat lamp on a temperature control thermostat.
So how simple can this process be? What are the very basics that you need to have once you've ordered your chicks? What should you be prepared with once they finally arrive? And Celia, why don't you go ahead?
I've been doing this for 8 years, and I'm just hoping that all the mistakes I've made you won't have to, and so that's why I like to be able to spread the word on how to raise chickens, because I've made a lot of mistakes. So one mistake I've made was not having a very secure little baby coop, so a place where those little chicks are warm enough and then also protected from your own cats, rats. I've had friends that have lost little baby chicks to rats. And so they need to be protected and warm. So from the wind, and that can be as easy as a cardboard box in your house. My first batch was in my house, and that was another mistake I made because they kick up a lot of dust and get kind of stinky. Even when you're cleaning out that little box every day, it's
they are just crazy wild characters. And so now I've also raised them in my garage, and now I actually have a brooding coop outdoors. And so it's evolved. So that protected place and knowing which breed you want to get, and so just food and water. So they're like any of your other pets or animals. They need the correct food. So I get that chick starter from IFA, and they have an organic option. And then waters that don't make a big mess. So you don't want your baby chicks to get wet. They have to stay warm and dry. So they make little perfect waters. And they even make waters now that have little nipples on them, so they're not splashing around and making a big mess in the water.
Now, that sounds like that would be a great thing to have, because the one thing I've noticed in raising chicks, that no matter where I put the water, mm-hmm. they somehow are able to fill it full of full of the shavings. And so I'm always having to clean it out, and you can't put it too high because then they can't reach it. But if you get it too low, then it's the shavings are in it all the time. So that so this is a new option that has a nipple on it?
Yeah, yeah. I just saw some at IFA the other day. It was just like a water bottle with the nipple turned upside down, and all they have to do is hit that little nipple, and they've made it red. Chickens love or are attracted to red, so they'll want to hit that. You can also get them online too.
Now, have either one of you used a red lamp rather than the white light to raise your chicks?
That's what I use, is the red heat lamp. Yes, and that's also nice because chickens are attracted to red. Having that red light keeps them calm. If one of the baby chicks accidentally gets injured, they can't see any red blood because of that red light.
Oh, and they'll go right after it. That's really difficult and kind of surprised me, although I thought, well, chickens, you know, I should understand this. But if one of them's injured, the rest of the flock go right after that injury.
Yep. So making sure that they have enough space. And I've learned a lot of this by doing it, but then also I really like Gail Damoreaux's Stories Guide to Raising Chickens. I still reference that all the time, and she tells you how big your coop should be for how many birds you have and how big the run outdoors and how to build your coop so they have enough ventilation. So this time of year, it's a really big deal to have proper ventilation. When it's 100-plus outside, that's when you can also start getting some deaths.
And what's the
so
name of the book?
Keeping the Coops in the Shade. So it's Gail Damoreaux's Stories Guide to Raising Chickens, and she actually just put out a new edition in 2010, and it has how to choose different breeds, how to create your shelter. She even has a really great first aid section now. It's a great reference book. And then another one that I love is Harvey Usery's The Small Scale Poultry Flock. So just depending on the size, the scale of how many chickens you're raising and that sort of thing, I would check out either just Gail Damoreaux's or both Harvey's and Gail's.
So just getting started out with the chicks, how much room should each chick have? So if you've got five chicks and you want to just put them in a box just to get started out, how is it, square footage per chick?
It is, and my mind's gone blank. What is it, Britt?
Well, keep in mind that chicks grow really fast. So when you first get them home, you can have them in a relatively small size box, but after about a week or two, they're going to start to get really big and really playful, and they're going to want to jump around. And so I actually have three chicks with me right here that I got from my IFA a couple weeks ago, and they're in about a 3 by maybe 4 foot kind of Tupperware bin, and we have a little perch in there so they can jump up on a perch and kind of start exploring that way. And that seems to be enough room for now. Once they go outside and start to get more full grown, that's when you really need to be aware of, yeah, how many square feet per chicken. And the Salt Lake City ordinance says you need to have 2 square feet per chicken, which isn't actually that much. that's especially if you just have a coop where your chickens aren't allowed to go outside, then you need to have 6 square feet per chicken.
Okay,
I have far more than that just because I have the space for it. And as Celia mentioned, you know, the more space they have, kind of sometimes the healthier they'll be.
Well, and Britt, I wanted to ask you then about the ordinances and what people should be looking for with their city, because not all cities are the same. Before we get into that, I wanted to give our phone number. If anyone has a question or a comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. If you have questions, you can also tweet them by going to hashtag AUGarden. And then you can also send us an email. Just go to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah, and you can email us your question. So let's take a look at ordinances. What have you seen from city to city? They change. They're not uniform.
Yeah, absolutely. So keep in mind, a lot of the ordinances that are on the books right now from cities are very outdated. They're sort of from when we had more agriculture land, and they're geared more towards large-scale farms. And so a lot of cities have taken it upon themselves to change those and update them, including Salt Lake City, who in 2009 reworked their chicken ordinance, which was so amazing. The problem with it was, though, it's just not quite, I don't know, reasonable, if you keep in mind, like, how the size of most folks' yards and how close houses tend to be to each other. And so Wasatch Community Gardens sort of took a look at those ordinances and talked to some of our friends like Celia and other chicken keepers that we know, and we made some recommendations for the ordinances, and we were lucky enough that Salt Lake City adopted all of them. So the current ordinance in Salt Lake City is that you can have up to 15 hens with no roosters allowed. Your chickens must be confined in a secure outdoor area. Let's see, they have to have a coop that's predator resistant, has to be covered and ventilated. We mentioned that, you know, 2 square feet per chicken if they're allowed to roam outside of the coop. If they're not allowed to roam outside of the coop, it has to be 6 square feet per chicken. And then this is sort of, I think, what maybe will prevent a lot of people from keeping chickens is that they have to be 25 feet away from a neighbor's dwelling. So, and then they can be as close to your house as you want them to be.
I'm sorry.
I know for myself, you know, my neighbor's house is about 5 feet from mine on either side. So that meant we had to put ours pretty far in our rear backyard.
Oh, the coop itself has to be 25 feet from the property line?
Correct, from a dwelling of a neighbor.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's one thing that's going to keep a lot of people from being able to keep them legally. And then Salt Lake County has sort of similar ordinances, but they are stipulated for each city. So Bluffdale, Cottonwood Heights, Draper, Holiday, Midvale, Murray, they all have different ordinances, including in Murray and West Valley City, they are unable to keep chickens. So
they just don't allow chickens at all?
Correct. Yeah, they're not on the books. I know there are definitely some folks in West Valley City specifically that I know of who are trying to have that changed. So if you're in residential zoning, you're just not allowed to keep them. You need to be in agricultural zoning.
So would you say that typically the more rural you are, the more likely you are to have be able to have chickens?
You know, not necessarily, actually. Surprisingly, West Valley City, you know, I guess it's sort of a changing demographic and changing zones, but I found, I mean, for example, Salt Lake City is very urban, you know, very downtown, and yet we're allowed, we have very, very great chicken-keeping ordinances. So I don't think it necessarily coincides with whether it's agriculture or not.
Well, I know in Hyde Park, where I live, that there are roosters all over the town. You can hear them in the morning. But that's one thing, if you are allowed roosters, that you need to be concerned about, because you do have neighbors most likely around you, and you don't want to have them be upset for waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning to a rooster crowing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, that's another thing a chicken keeper has to be aware of, is just sort of neighbors, and chickens make noises as well. And in fact, I've had several hens who have taken it upon themselves to start crowing at different times. And we definitely try to sweeten the deal a little bit by giving our neighbors eggs when we have extra, or inviting their kids over to hang out with the chickens and to help feed them. So, and also keep in mind that ordinances are really only, they're not, what's the word I'm trying to say? It's not like there's animal control driving around looking in backyards trying to find people who are illegally keeping chickens. They're more on a complaint basis, right? If you have a neighbor who calls in, if you have a chicken keeping permit, then you have something to back you up, right?
Now, I will say that there is a difference with homegrown chickens and eggs than there is from what you get in the store. There's a definite difference. And we sell our eggs, and people tell us all the time, your eggs, they just hold up. They're not as runny. They're much more dark golden yellow with the yolk, and they taste better. Is that what you generally find, Celia?
It's amazing how different they are. Every once in a while, I'll see somebody crack open a grocery store chicken, and I'll wonder if their chickens are sick or something. The yolks are so pale, and it just seems kind of gross to me. I'm spoiled now. Yeah, so our chickens get to eat bugs and plants, and that affects them. And I actually just learned that grocery store eggs can be 3 to 4 months old, too. So just the freshness issue, too, is different. So
now, I don't know if you would know this or not, but do you cook differently with fresh eggs versus what you would get in the store?
I'm not much of a baker, but I've heard different pastry chefs will use different aged eggs for specific, like whipping the whites and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then boiling an egg is different. Have you noticed how you boil your eggs and they're harder to peel?
Yes. They're much harder to peel.
Yeah, so because they are so fresh, the inside, they're actually pressing up against the shell. And the older they get, the more that shrinks away from the shell. So for me, I actually leave some of my eggs out of the refrigerator for about a week, and then I boil them, just to kind of age them. So Gail Damereau in her book talks about how eggs will age about for every 24 hours outside of the fridge. That's like about a week of being inside the fridge. So I then kind of age them, and so they end up being about the same age as the grocery store eggs that are easier to peel.
Well,
I've also noticed that different breeds have eggs that are easier or less easy to peel. Like my Americanas, which are the Eastern egg layers, so they're kind of like bluey eggs, they tend to be a lot easier to boil. So whenever I boil eggs, I will use her eggs. I don't know if you guys have found that, but...
Yeah, actually, I have. And you mentioned the Americanas. I have the Americanas, and people love to get our eggs because they open them up and there'll be maybe one white one, there'll be about 8 brown ones, and then they have we have green ones, we have light blue ones, pink ones. So it's kind of cool to see this variety of eggs.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever had a cuckoo meringue lays sort of a dark chocolate colored egg?
No, I've never had one of those.
Yeah.
They're so beautiful.
Well, we're just at the half point of our program. We have another half hour left, but right now we're going to listen to the latest edition of Wild About Utah. But I want to leave you both with a question. It's the most common question that I get, and I kind of laugh to myself when I get it, but we'll answer it when we come back. And the question is, do you need to have a rooster to get eggs? So stay tuned for the rest of Access Utah coming up in just a minute.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. Citizen science networks are proliferating across the globe. These networks conduct important research that could not otherwise be accomplished. And they do it using non-professional, mostly volunteer labor. An army of civilian data collectors can capture more data over a larger area and at a relatively small cost. Aside from collecting data, participants can generate ideas and help coordinate various aspects of a particular program. Many citizen-driven networks collect environmental data at prescribed locations. Wielding smartphones with GPS receivers, anyone can instantaneously and accurately determine their geographic coordinates to submit along with their observations. The Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count is one of the oldest and most successful examples of citizen science networks. Since 1900, volunteers have been collecting information about local populations of birds. More recent examples include Frogwatch USA for observing frogs and toads, Project Budburst for observing the leafing and flowering of plants in relation to changing weather patterns, and the World Water Monitoring Challenge for observing water quality indicators. One project that recently piqued my interest is the U.S. Nightjar Survey Network, coordinated by the Center for Conservation Biology in Virginia. What in the world is a nightjar, you might ask? Is it something you take camping so you don't have to get out of the tent? No, a nightjar is a medium-sized, plump-looking bird with long wings, a broad head, and a very short bill. Nightjars have short legs in relation to their bodies, so they aren't great at walking. They are exceptional flyers, though, catching moths and other insects in mid-flight. Nightjars are very hard to see because of their camouflage plumage, and because they are mostly active after sunset and before sunrise. Thus, you'd want to memorize their very distinctive calls if you're going to try to find them. Two nightjars breed regularly in Utah. We have the common porwill, which sounds like this. That's the eastern whippoorwill without the whip. Another Utah breeder is the common nighthawk, which sounds like this. The Nightjar Survey for Utah and other northern states begins June 27th and runs through July 11th, 2012. Individual surveys are easy to perform and do not take more than 2 hours to complete. Surveyors work at night when the moon is at least half full. You need to drive, stopping at 10 points along a 9-mile route. At each point, you count all nightjars seen or heard during a 6-minute period. To participate in a survey, you can sign up for a pre-existing route or design your own route. There are many routes left in all parts of Utah. For pictures of these extremely interesting birds and a link to the remaining nightjar survey routes, go to www.wildaboututah.org. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Hello, welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today we're talking about poultry. And online with us from Salt Lake City, first we have Britt Merrill. She's a community gardener and volunteer manager with Wasatch Community Gardens. Britt has been raising backyard chickens for 4+ years and was instrumental in helping Salt Lake City craft its updated chicken keeping ordinance. Celia Bell is an urban farmer. Celia has a large plot of land where she's able to raise chickens and bees and grow the majority of the food she needs. She's been raising chickens for 8+ years in Salt Lake, as well as a couple of years in a more rural area. Celia teaches urban chicken keeping classes for the U of U's Lifelong Learning Program and for Wasatch Community Gardens. Okay, when we last spoke, I asked you both a question because it's the one I get most often. And so why don't we answer it? And that is, do you need to have roosters to have eggs?
I also often get that question, and the answer is no.
And it's not. And I sometimes, if I know the person really well, I'll just say, well, think of humans. Well, what happens every month? I mean, it's an egg is produced, and with chickens, it's the same way. You don't need to have the male. If you want to have fertilized eggs, then yes, that would be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And chickens lay, on average, you know, about 200 eggs a year, sort of depending on the breed and variety. Some of the heavier producers will make more than that. In fact, I think the record is like 300 eggs or something.
Wow. So what kind of breed was that?
What was that?
What kind of breed was that?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I think it was one of the commercial breeds, like a Rhode Island Red or a Leghorn, who are some of the heavier sort of producers, really well known for, producing a lot of eggs.
Well, you know, one of the things that I looked at, and this is where we can move to next, is talking about the different breeds. I wanted to have a variety of chickens. When I got that first magazine from Murray McMurray, I just thought, oh, I got to have one of these and one of these. But the longer I've been doing it, the more I want to make sure I have consistent egg production. So I have a few different breeds, but then I also have a number of what are known as sex links because they're gentle hens and they tend to produce quite regularly. So what kind of breeds do you recommend?
Oh, goodness. I don't know, so if you want to take this one, if you want me to, but I think it really depends on your purposes for raising chickens. For me, I sort of like the social aspects of chickens. I really like to observe and watch them, and so production isn't necessarily what I'm going for. And so I tend to like some of the more like fancy breeds or rare breeds who might be even in critical status, meaning that unless we do something to help protect the breed, they might go extinct. And so those are the breeds that I tend to really go for, the ones who have like fancy foot feathers or 5 toes instead of 4 toes or crested heads. And some of my favorites have been a mottled Houdan, who's just a beautiful black and white chicken. She has a feather crest on her head and 5 toes. And she was one of the very social breeds that I had who would run up to you every time you'd walk outside and was a great forager. Let's see. One of my other favorites are the Cochins. I don't know if you've seen them. And this is a breed that comes
with the feathered shanks.
Yes, the very feathered feet, beautiful kind of round chicken. And they're just so sweet. The one downside about them is that they tend to go broody. And when a chicken goes broody, that means she tries to sit on her eggs so she can hatch those eggs. Now, of course, we don't have a rooster, so she's sitting on unfertilized eggs. But in her mind, you know, she's becoming a mother. So you can do a couple of things to try to get chickens out of their brood cycle. And depending on, you know, if we're around or maybe we're out of town and have a chicken keeper, I'll either let her go broody and finish out her cycle, or I'll try to break her of that.
I always feel guilty taking eggs from a broody hen.
Yes, they definitely don't appreciate that, do they?
And have you ever put the little wooden eggs that look like a real egg underneath them?
I have, and especially that's a really great trick if you're trying to train a hen where to lay. I know some people, especially if they keep chickens, maybe they let them roam in their backyard. You'll get chickens laying all sorts of places under bushes, corners of your yard. And so when you put a wooden egg or even a golf ball back in the nest box and leave it there, that they kind of like to lay their eggs where other chickens are laying. And so that can kind of trick them into laying where you want them to lay.
I had one trying to hatch a light bulb.
Oh, wow.
She was out in the barn, and there was a light bulb in an old area where I had had chicks before. But everywhere I moved that light bulb, she'd try to sit on top of it. So I was trying to replace it. So the chickens really can be a lot of fun. Well, first we've got our first phone call. We have Aggie calling from Ogden. Hi, Aggie. How can we help?
Actually, I've just got a few tips. I've raised chickens for eggs and for meat for several years. Actually got away from it, and we finally got back into it this year. I've got Huracanas and Rhode Island Red straight run, and then I also got a couple of dozen Cornish cross for meat chickens, and that way we'll have some for the freezer and some for egg production later on.
Now, which ones taste the best?
Pardon me?
Which ones taste the best?
Well, the Cornish cross are the best for eating. They're bred to not have feathers or brains.
Okay.
but they grow so fast that you have to put vitamin supplement in their water, or they'll actually get, I think, the equivalent of rickets. Their legs will twist to the point where they can't walk to get to food or to water, which is pretty much not so good.
And it is, as far as how many do you have? I mean, you're in Ogden. Are you in the more urban area or on the edge of town?
No, we're out in unincorporated Weber County, so I don't have to worry about zoning issues or neighbors. Well, not a whole lot. Two dozen of each of those breeds.
And do your chickens range pretty free?
I have to keep them penned. We have several cats, and we have raccoons and skunks and foxes and dogs that are a problem, so I need to keep them penned in. I would like to keep some out loose for eating bugs in my garden, but I found that those heavier breeds have a tendency to destroy the garden while they're eating the bugs.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I wanted to bring that up and ask both Britt and Celia, well, is it worth having them in the garden? Because I've found the same thing. I haven't been able to grow watermelon in the last 4 years because just when they get large enough and start to sweeten up, a chicken will come along and peck at it, and then pretty soon the whole thing's reamed out.
Celia, do you want to take that?
Sure. My chickens get the garden in the winter because all the crops that I care about are in little hoop houses. So that's kind of when they do the cleanup. And then as soon as my garlic starts poking up in the spring, that's when they have to get relegated to their fenced-in run. I also have a little what they call chicken tractors or a portable coop so I can once a crop of lettuce is finished, I can fence off that 1 4-foot by 25-foot bed, and they'll finish the older lettuce, poop there, till it in, so they're kind of preparing the garden bed to get planted again. So, but yeah, I've heard lots of people losing a lot of strawberries and tomatoes along with those earwigs.
Well, I was looking out, this is a couple of years ago, but I was looking out in the garden and I saw my chickens hopping and they were in my raspberry patch. I thought, what the heck are they doing? They were actually flying up to get the raspberries. So I quickly put them back in. So, well, Aggie, do you have any other questions or comments?
Have any of you ever tried Banty chickens for pest control in gardens?
That's a good question. I have never tried a bantam chicken. So bantam chickens are like regular chickens, except they're about a quarter to a fifth of the size, and you do also get some unique breeds that come along with specific to bantam chickens. And I haven't tried them.
I had a girlfriend in my neighborhood that had read that bantam chickens were better in the garden. They wouldn't do as much damage. And they still were able to find those strawberries and tomatoes and raspberries. And they are so lightweight that they were able to fly over the fence, the 5-foot fence, whenever they wanted to go harvest things in the garden. So that experiment didn't work very well for her.
I have heard that, too, from a friend, that it's better. But you do need to keep an eye on them. They aren't as destructive, but they also like red, as previously mentioned. I've got a couple of other suggestions about keeping eggs and boiling eggs. And I don't know, I learned this, I think, from an old gal up in the panhandle, when I lived up in the panhandle of Idaho, that the point, you know how an egg has kind of a pointy end and a round end? She always said that if you put the pointy end down into the carton, they will keep longer. Now, I don't know. I've never really done a quantitative experiment on that.
I've read that as well. I think that's in Gail Damrow's book, actually.
So. Is that because the air pocket inside there, is that on the round end? Does that have anything to do with it?
I guess so.
That was the explanation I heard. I just had read to do that because, you get that air pocket and it end up being easier to peel.
Okay.
I hadn't heard that it lasted longer at all.
The other suggestion that's worked for us over the years is when we boil eggs, we add copious amounts of salt, like a half a cup for a dozen eggs. It seems to make them peel easier.
I'm going to try that.
Great.
It doesn't affect the taste of the egg, but it does seem to, I mean, we've gotten in the habit of it. Even now we buy store-bought eggs, we still put salt in there because it makes them peel easier as well.
Well, thank you, Aggie. Appreciate your comments.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The time is going quickly. If you'd like to join our conversation, there's only about 10 minutes left. On the line with me from Salt Lake are Britt Merrill and Celia Bell, Wasatch Community Garden instructors. And if you'd like to talk poultry, chickens, ducks, geese, give us a call, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden or email us at upr.org. Just click on the programs tab and you'll see Access Utah and you can email us your question. Now, as far as looking at the different varieties, if you were just starting out, what would you look to do? I mean, initially I would probably say to get a sex link because they raise or they do eggs so well and they tend not to get broody, but I guess it really depends on what you want them for.
So that's the black sex link is the only chicken that I keep now. It's nice because when they are chicks, you can tell which ones are the roosters. The roosters have a white marking on their head, so it's easier to sex them because a lot of times you can go to IFA and say, I want all pullets, so females that are less than 1 year old. But they can be tough to be able to tell if they're roosters or not. And so sometimes you get a rooster, this has kept me from having to deal with that part of it. And right now, so my chickens are a year old, and I'm still getting between 11 and 14 eggs a day, and I have 14 hens. So, and they still lay well in the winter. I had some Americanas that it'd start getting a little chilly, and they'd be like, I don't know if I'm going to lay. So that's, I've definitely gotten more into the sex links. I'm sold.
So should I insulate my coop? so it doesn't get quite as cold? Because I know that the day length can affect the laying as well as the temperature. What do you think, Celia?
So we have a unique setup at our house. So we have the summer quarters and the winter quarters, and our winter area is our coop. It's unique in that it's all salvage materials, but we do have Pink Panther insulation in the walls, not exposed because the chickens will peck at that, any sort of insulation they'll want to peck at that. And then it actually has southern glass too, so I can put the chicken water up against that southern glass in the winter, and it'll keep it from freezing during the day. I don't have electricity going out there, so it'll still freeze at night, but it won't freeze during the day, which is a big help. And then I actually have bottomless drawers underneath the roost so that I can pull those out from the outside, and that the litter that the pine shavings and poop that they've been pooping all night just kind of come out, and it's super easy to clean. I can walk inside of it, and it is really nice in the winter. So keeping things dry, well ventilated, but not drafty is huge in the winter, and then shady and cool in the summer.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of things here that I have found really important, and that's making sure that you continue to keep your coop clean. I mean, you do have to muck. I'd always threaten my son when he's acting up, boy, I'm going to send you out to muck out the chicken coop if you don't behave. So you have to keep that area clean because that will keep the diseases down. And then fresh, clean water. Those are probably the two most important things.
So make it easy for you, because once you have everything set up, you've chosen your breed that you want, you have your coop set up, really the everyday maintenance is not a big deal as long as you make it easy on yourself to clean that out and get them fresh water. You don't want to be hauling water long distances any time of year.
Now, we have an online question from Felipe. I'm going to butcher this last name. I hope not. Quiroz. And he says, hello, is there a sure way to tell if your eggs are too old to eat? I've heard that if you put them in water, the bad eggs will float. Is that the case?
Yes. Yep. So those eggs that I've left out on my counter to boil, they actually, instead of just sitting on the bottom of the bowl of water, that bottom end that has the air pocket will kind of pop up. But if they're really old, they will float because that air pocket's even bigger. And Gail Damereau's book, she actually has a diagram, and where they end up floating in the water, you can tell how old they are.
Okay, great. We have a caller. We have Adele Moran from Cedarview. Hi, Adele. How can we help?
Hi. I just had some interesting comments on your Morans. This is the first year we have grown those. They lay the darkest egg of any chickens. And also, from the one study, it says it's the only breed of chickens where the salmonella can't enter through the egg because the pores are so close. And it was also interesting that in 1927, a couple were so impressed with the Morans, they decided to import some from France, but the laws wouldn't allow them to do it, so they put a whole bunch of eggs in a Easter basket like they were boiled eggs and were able to import them. So it's kind of an interesting fact.
That would be interesting trying to sneak them past. So how many do you have?
We have there's the dark copper Morans. They are the ones that lay the darkest, and then we have the Cucumeran that's a gray color, but we've really been impressed with them.
And how did you obtain them?
We got them through Murray McMurray.
Okay. And have you found them, when you've ordered through the mail, have you found the breeds to be fairly true to breed? I ran into a few problems with that when taking them to the fair. They weren't always true to breed.
These have been so far.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dale.
Hey, okay, thank you. Great. Very interesting program.
Thanks for listening. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, we have just a little bit of time. We're down to about 4 minutes left if you want to get in a quick question. It's 1-800-826-1495, or you can tweet us at hashtag AUGarden, or go to upr.org, click on Access, the Programs tab, and click on Access Utah. So I'm just remembering a couple of the breeds that I have. If you want to raise chicks, and you do have a rooster, my Buff Orpingtons just love to set, and they're a larger breed of chicken. I have two of them. One of them is pretty gentle. The other one, I have to have a glove on when I reach under her to get other eggs that the hens still lay in the same box. And it's interesting, through the experience of having chickens, you just kind of learn little things to do. Like, no one told me that I need to put an X on the eggs that they're sitting on, so that you can remember and keep those in under her, because they take, what, about 21 days to hatch?
Yeah. Yep, that's correct.
So I've got four new chicks, and I've got another hen that went broody. And my question for you both is, when one goes broody, does that kind of automatically tell others to get broody? Because for 2 years, I haven't had any broody hens. And then I had one go broody this year, and within a week I had four more that went broody.
That's a great question. And I tend to, some of the breeds that I really like the Cochin is another breed that tends to go really broody, you know, a couple times a year. And I've never seen it impact the other chickens in terms of them going broody, but it definitely impacts the social structure. When she goes broody, the pecking order gets all mixed up. And so I see that my chickens kind of fight a little bit more. And then when she comes back down, they have to kind of reassert the pecking order. Just really interesting social issues, I think.
And it's also interesting to watch them as mothers, because some are better mothers than others. I had a Japanese bantam that usually they are not very broody, but she was the best little mother, and I kept her as long as I could, because she would just be fierce with the other chickens when they even came close to getting her. And that also brings up something else. You can take the eggs that you want to be hatched, and you can actually set them on the counter so that they can all be done at the same time, and then like within a day or two of each other, and then I put them underneath the hen that's actually broody that I want to hatch the eggs.
Oh, that's great. I've never done that. I've never hatched eggs, and I've always wanted to, especially with my Cochin, who is constantly going broody. So,
well,
that's great.
The day before they hatch, you can hear the chicks peeping in the shells.
How fun.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. Well, we've reached the end of our time. We've got a gardening calendar that's coming up, but I wanted to say thank you to you both, Britt Merrill, Community Gardener and Volunteer Manager with Wasatch Community Gardens, and Celia Bell, an urban farmer that also teaches through Wasatch Community Gardens. Thank you for joining us on the program.
It's been a lot of fun.
And we'll have to do this again.
Save yourself time and energy and improve the look of your lawn by mulching, not bagging your grass clippings. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Grass clippings don't cause thatch. Short clippings break down quickly, adding nutrients, moisture, and organic matter to the soil. In fact, a season's worth of clippings is equal to one fertilization, saving you a bit of time and money. No mulching mower? Don't worry. We all should mow our lawns often, removing no more than 1 inch of grass with each cutting. It's better for your lawn and results in short clippings that break down quickly. Mow over longer clippings to break them down to size. Or put those long clippings to work in the garden or compost. Spread a thin layer of herbicide-free clippings over the soil surface in your garden to suppress weeds and conserve moisture. Don't use clippings from treated lawns. These can damage, even kill your desirable plants. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.